Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, producer of the show. Pharma Talk Radio is a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to those in life sciences and, in particular, drug development. And this, of course, always includes patients and patient advocacy. Today's program is dedicated to the topic of an alternative model to transform a funding gap in clinical research. I'm so happy to welcome back Craig Lipset as our guest host for today's program. Craig is Head of Clinical Innovation, R&D at Pfizer. And it was Craig who originally brought the story to my attention that we are about to discuss, and we first presented it in London at the DPharm Europe conference. Joining Craig is our guest, Alexander Masters, author, campaigner, and co-founder, iCancer.org.uk. So, Craig, welcome back, and great to have you on the show.
Valerie, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back with you today. I've been enjoying following all the great podcasts that you've been posting in the meantime at Pharma Talk Radio. This is a great topic, and as usual, it's a story that was really exciting to follow in the news, and Val, through your magic and wizardry, were able to track down and engage Alexander to help to share that story with this audience. As usual, I'll preface by saying, while I am employed by Pfizer, the views I'll express are those of myself. Today we're going to talk about an interesting story at the convergence of patient centricity, crowdfunding, bioethics. Can you buy a seat in a clinical trial? And what if that's the only way that funding is going to be available to develop that medicine at all? The only way that any patients would be able to gain access to that medicine. Is that bad for patients, or is that the future role for patients to truly be at the center of clinical research? As Val mentioned, with us today is Alexander Masters. Welcome, Alexander.
Hello. Hello, Craig. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you. It's great to have you here. I love your bio line on LinkedIn, just as Val had mentioned, journalist and medical campaigner. That's a very interesting tag, and I think that probably speaks very nicely to the journey that you've been on over the last few years. Alexander, what brought you from being a journalist into this world of clinical trials?
Well, I began even more remote than a journalist. I'm by profession, I'm a biographer, and I'm not investigative journalist at all. What started was the woman I did a lot of writing with, who was my editor and with whom I exchanged manuscripts all the time and without whom I felt bereft if I was trying to present something for publication, contracted this cancer, neuroendocrine cancer of the pancreas. It's the same type that Steve Jobs had. And I just didn't know what to do about it. I was aware through my reading that there was very little that could be done to help her. You know, she could have her life could be extended, but there would come a point when the traditional therapies, which I was perfectly happy with her having, and she was happy to have, I knew they'd run out. So I began to look, without any medical training, without any background in the field at all, at what I might be able to do to provide her with something once those traditional therapies had run their course.
And so where did that search take you?
Well, all over the place. I began in a very scattergun sort of fashion and looked on the internet, of course, and went to the I lived in Cambridge and went to the university medical library and pestered all the people I knew who were doctors and pestered a friend of mine who was a professor at Imperial College. And so occasionally I'd come across the odd piece of research that looked promising or that I felt was... My idea was I wanted to get a trial for Dido. That was her name, Dido. I wanted to get a trial for her ready so that by the time these traditional therapies had failed, I would have sweet-talked the professor who was running the trial into allowing my friend Dido onto the trial in the 3 or 4 years it would take. You know, in 3 or 4 years' time, by which point the traditional therapies would have run their course. So I approached this professor at Imperial, for example, about some kooky thing that was going on in London in Harley Street, and he managed to put me right about that. And bit by bit, I built up a sense of what constituted nonsense and what constituted something that was worth looking at further. YouTube was invaluable to me, and it was really, I was looking at a YouTube video about Canadian pigs, as it happened, and saw on this YouTube video, it was about Canadian pigs because he discovered that in these pigs was a sort of virus that specifically targeted neuroendocrine cancers. And I was interested by that. So I stopped the YouTube and freeze-framed the particular scene because at the back, just behind the lectern, I could see the address of a company that had been developing this virus for a potential treatment. I rang them up. They'd gone bust 3 years before. But it put me on the track of something, and so I started looking through the literature. Although I'm a journalist and a biographer, I trained as a physicist, and so I kind of like looking at scientific journals, even if I can't understand what they're saying. And so I started looking and tried to get a best sense of what was going on, and came across this potential therapy that had been developed and had shown remarkable success in preclinical trials and preclinical, you know, experiments that had been developed in Uppsala in Sweden, the University of Uppsala in Sweden, which is a center of excellence for this type of cancer. So I rang the professor of that place up and asked him, why haven't you developed this therapy into trials?
And what feedback did you get?
Well, I think he's one of the main heroes of the story because he picked up the phone. I'm not sure I would, if some peculiar biography rang up sort of wittering about this, that, and the other and wanting his friend on a trial. I mean, but I think things have changed a lot in the last 10 years, and the internet and the notion of crowdsourcing and crowdfunding and so on and so forth has made people much more amenable to approaches from outsiders. And he was one of these people. He picked up the phone and listened to me and said, well, the reason he hadn't developed the trial was because he'd run out of money. So I said, how much money? And he said he needed about $1.5 million, $2 million to get it into an early phase 1/phase 2A trial. So I said, well, if I get you the money, will you promise to put my friend Dido on the trial? And he said, yes.
So I want to make sure I'm following all of this. So a biographer has a friend with a devastating cancer diagnosis. You do what many friends might do. You turn to the internet in hopes of trying to help find solutions for your friend's need or the anticipated need, that knowing the course and the direction of her illness. You carry that forward online and find information, right? Everybody out there will search on Google and YouTube and find a ridiculous amount of information. But somehow you end up, you know, dissecting this information right down to a frame on YouTube to chase down a researcher in Uppsala and get him on the phone and down to the level of granularity that he needs $1.5 million in order to do the clinical trial.
Yeah.
That's about it.
I think one of the things that I realized early on, and I felt quite, I think perhaps this was the little scientific training I've got where it helped me, is I didn't want an alternative therapy for Dido. I wasn't interested in peculiar things to do with whatever they're to do with, you know, from New Mexico or Latvia. I didn't want one of those. I wanted something that was really good, that was peer-reviewed, and that would come in subsequent to the traditional treatments. So I wasn't trying to rush about proposing excessive amounts of vitamin C or other things like that. And the positive thing of that is it knocked out a lot of the internet stuff. I didn't have to deal with it then. Mm-hmm. What I had to look for, what I had to get to understand, was where I found the good quality research that might be leading to clinical trials.
That's not a threshold that your mainstream your mainstream friend of a sick patient is going to be able to hold up, right? That required that scientific background, that scientific training.
No, I don't agree. I mean, I think what it required in my case is that I wasn't frightened by medical journals. I mean, I couldn't understand them any better than the next person, but because I had the training in physics, I mean, this is a guess, I don't know, but because I had that training in physics, I had a feeling that at least I could try and understand what was going on. I wouldn't understand it very well, but at least I could make a first shot at it. And so it quickly, after looking at this freeze-frame video and discovering the address, it quickly became clear what sort of work I needed to look at. And then I'd ask friends of mine who were involved in medicine or biology or genetics, I'd ask friends of mine to sort of explain what was happening. And then when I first found out about Uppsala, I mean, I'd never heard of Uppsala before, and I certainly didn't know anything about genetically modified viruses. So I got in hold of some people in Oxford who I knew who'd gone to university there, and some people in Manchester and so on, and got them to put me in touch with scientists who were experts in the field to ask them, was this any good? Mm. So it was doggedness rather than science. I think there are since doing this, I have come across the most heroic people in terms of ability to ferret out lost bits of information. I think anyone could do this. It's just a matter of keeping going, and an extraordinary amount of luck, I'll admit that as well, and having a nice man like Magnus Essend at the end of the phone in Uppsala.
So let's pick up from there. So you would think that would be enough of the story. You find out he needs $1.5 million. I take it you were not sitting on a check for $1.5 million.
No, I wasn't. So we wandered around the hospital. He was very nice, and I met the woman who worked with him, Justyna Leja, who was his PhD student and then had developed this virus as a postdoc and was now the principal worker on it. And I went into the hospital and met the clinician there, who was a leading figure in the European neuroendocrine cancer world. So I was fairly confident this was a good thing. And I was trying to think, how am I going to raise $1.5 million? I don't have that. I don't know anyone in my family who has that. And certainly Dido didn't have it. So the only thing I could think of at the time was I needed a gimmick. I needed something to get attention from newspapers. And so I asked him, well, if we could find someone to fund this, would you be prepared to name the virus after that person? I didn't know whether you could name a virus after a person, but it seemed a nice thing. I mean, imagine if you get a virus named after you because you've discovered a treatment for a type of cancer. Sounds wonderful. So he said, yes, if you find such a person, I will name the virus after them. And it turns out you can do something with the second syllable of the name somehow. There's some European Union directive on it. So I came back to England with my gimmick and with my need for $1.5 million. And I wrote an article, and I thought to myself, well, what newspaper am I going to put this article in? And I know a couple of newspaper people. I'm not a regular journalist, but I do a bit here and there. And I thought, well, what I need is a newspaper that is read by rich people. And there are a couple in Britain, and generally the daily one is called The Telegraph. So I thought, right, and I'd written for them before, so I thought, I'm going to place this article in The Telegraph. So I rang up The Telegraph and told them I wanted to do that, and they said, yes, go ahead, and I wrote it up. But in the meantime, I also thought there's another paper here that's the Financial Times. Now, rich people read that. So I managed to get one of the editors there, who turned out to be a friend of the sister of a friend of mine, I managed to get hold of him. And then on the same day, the piece came out in the Financial Times and my article in the Telegraph saying, look, here's this amazing... Well, I was very careful not to say it that way. Here's this potential therapeutic. It might mean nothing. It might be no good, but it might be something. And it doesn't cost much for us to find out. And I think it was partly because it was a good story of someone from the outside coming in and finding something. And then, you know, it's just an interesting subject. And the idea of these viruses that can attack cancer is such an intriguing idea that most people don't know anything about. So it did well on the social media. But in addition to that, and this is what, in a way, really caught the person I was after, the Financial Times ran a slightly joking editorial. So there were two pieces in the Financial Times, the main piece and this joking editorial saying, well, we all know trials can go disastrously wrong. What happens if this one does? Do you then name it after your worst enemy? And that was sort of jokey, and they imagined Coca-Cola naming it after Pepsi and so on. So it was that editorial and the article there in the Financial Times that, in fact, was read by a oil man from Arizona who was in Geneva drinking his cup of coffee out by the lake. And he got interested. Now, we didn't know about that for a long time. It took a long time for little machineries of the banking world to go on. But in the meantime, we'd set up a crowdfunding campaign. And by we, I mean a person 2 weeks after my article appeared, another person, another journalist, wrote a reply piece in the Telegraph saying, I've got that cancer too. If I had your money, if I had the money you needed, I'd give it to you immediately. And it was a brilliant, brilliant article by this man, Dominic Nutt. And we met, set up a campaign group, which is called icancer.org.uk, and he brought in a crowdfunding expert who was a friend of his, and that was astonishing. The effect of that was astounding. I mean, I'm a bit old for the social media generation, to be honest, and I can never quite get into it, but I have been amazed by the effect it had and the quality of the people contributing and volunteering things and the expertise, well, less the expertise and more the determination that the people in the crowd who read about our campaign and gave us money on Indiegogo, the amount of time they'd spend making sure we weren't cheats, that the science was good, the people they'd consultants to make sure the science was good. So they were brilliantly suspicious, and as a result, they kind of presented a, you know, like a people's peer review. It was a wonderful thing to watch, and we raised around, well, I'm not sure what it is in dollars, but around £700,000-£800,000 that way.
But that takes time, right? And you're probably hearing this very loud clock ticking as you're looking at your friend and watching dollars slowly tick in through the crowdfunding site.
Yes, of course. But it was 8 months later. We got it in 8 months.
Mm.
And the crowdfunding had the crowdfunding was sufficient by that 8 month period to enable the preclinical research to be pushed forward and to start setting up all the stuff you have to do to get things into clinical trials. It wasn't enough to get it actually going, of course, but it was enough to get the university and the department interested in resurrecting this work. And in the meantime, a few months after I'd written those articles, I heard first about this oil man in Arizona, though he had actually read the article on the same day. And so we knew within about 4 months, 5 months perhaps, of us starting this campaign, that there was a possibility, he hadn't settled on it yet, but that there was the possibility that he might be prepared to fund the gap between whatever the crowd raised and whatever was needed.
So in the meantime, are you getting, as this story is evolving, I imagine there are all sorts of not only business implications, but ethical questions that are starting to swirl, even just based on some of the joking tone of the articles that you were mentioning in the media. I'm sure some bioethicists' heads start swirling. There's one of the headlines that the Telegraph picked up was how the wealthy paying to be guinea pigs in clinical trials could help cure us all.
I know, aren't they wonderful? They certainly know how to get people going.
Absolutely. So with provocative headlines like that, where were the ethicists leading you, or were you leading them?
We were caught, really. I mean, at the beginning, I still had this idea of this gimmick in mind, and then only later did I really realize what the force of the campaign was, that whoever paid the money for the trial would want the same deal that I'd got for Dido. They'd want a place on the trial. And then I realized that's the thing that attracts attention. That's the thing that'll attract big money, the money, the extra money we need to get this trial going quickly. Now, you can phrase that in all sorts of ways. And on the one hand, I wanted publicity, so I'd say, you know, I think we should sell trial places to, you know, the richest person. So that would get me nice bits of publicity. But on the other hand, I realized that although ethically that sounds horrific, it isn't actually what it's about. What it's about is a neglected potential therapeutic that no one is prepared to fund, no one of the traditional sources is prepared to fund, but which could potentially help a lot of people. And it's about one rich person saying, I will pay for this entire trial, the whole thing, everyone on it, every poorer person on it, all the paperwork, everything. All I ask is at the end, you'll tack me on too. Now, ethically, that's a lot less complicated. It seems to me that's a fairly fair deal. You know, it's not as if this money is being taken away from some other way of getting hold of, you know, some other funding. It's not being taken away from some other research. It's new money. And it's money being presented by someone who has the disease and is willing to help everyone else around him to have a shot at this medication. Not only have a shot at this potential medication, but prepared to share the risks in a trial, because it's not only that the trial might not work, it might go wildly wrong. He might die as a consequence of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's happened. I mean, it wasn't long ago that just happened in France.
Right.
So I think when you think about it, when you're not thinking in terms of headlines, and to begin with, I was thinking only in terms of headlines. I needed to get this information out. I needed to get people talking about it. I didn't mind if ethicists disapproved of it, as long as they thought about it. Because if they thought about it and talked about it, they'd tell other people, and those other people would tell other people, and the information would get out.
Mm.
So I was caught between the two modes of approach, the one wanting to be sensible and win round the scholars and the people who ultimately are the ones I need to approve this mechanism of funding. But on the other hand, I just needed to get the story about.
Exciting. So you're pushing forward, and let's see, it was around 2004, right, that a lot of those articles are swirling. It's probably around that year that you get connected with that businessman in Arizona.
No, 2013.
Oh, sorry. 2012.
Yeah, 2012. Sorry. I published it October 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Then 2013, the money came in.
Yeah, clearly I'm operating in a different decade in my head today. So this is 2012. 2013. Now we're into 2016. It's April of 2016. If this is archived online, that's when we're speaking today. A lot has happened since. Some people have not survived to see the progress that you've realized.
Well, it is a slow process. And obviously, to begin with, I thought, and you know, wanting for Dido the quickest possible way, I thought, well, if I can get this money, they can get going. It's surely not going to take that long to get paperwork sorted out. I know they've done all the experiments. I've seen the results. I've had them. I conducted my own sort of independent peer review. I'm not claiming it's the most best peer review, but I rang up all the experts I could get hold of, John Bell in Ottawa, who's the leading virotherapist in the world, as far as I can understand, got him to look at the papers and approve of it. I found if you just rang people up, you could get hold of them and get things done. So I got this peer review done fairly quickly. There were people in Oxford and people in Manchester and people in Leeds, I also asked. And they all agreed there was something really exciting about this work. There was some potential there. But I hadn't properly understood just how slow the process is. I mean, it is maddening. And partly, I think also I'd hoped that when we got the Texan the Arizona oil man, his name is Vince Hamilton, by the way, that, you know, he would come in and kick people around a bit and push. I felt a good, strong business interest would be a good thing, you know, sort people out a bit. And he did. He did get things moving. But then he died. And he died fairly shortly after giving the money. I flew out to visit him. He was a lovely, lovely man. And we had a fascinating conversation where we were talking about this potential therapeutic, this oncolytic virus. But it was all in terms of the metaphor of oil wells. And he said, you see, the thing is, as an oil man, I'm used to taking risks that usually cost about $2 million to sink a small well, costs him about that. And 9 times out of 10, it's a loss of money. It doesn't go anywhere. I'm used to those sort of gambles. These are in the figures I deal with. I don't understand, he said, why businessmen don't always do this. Why isn't the business world always doing this? Whenever one of it gets sick, one of us rich business people gets sick, why don't we invest at the beginning, just after we've been diagnosed, before it's too late, in these neglected therapeutics, if there are some lying around, and get them ready and up and running so that by the time the traditional therapies have failed us, we have something to go to. It might not work, it might, but at least we have something. So I had thought with him and his sense of urgency and the fact that we got the money so quick and the fact that it was, you know, the researchers were far ahead in the preclinical work, that it would be done in a year. I've just come back last week from, finally, the first patient has received the drug. It has taken 4 years. And it was in 2013 when we finally were aware we did have the money. We had it all. It was secure. We could pay pay Uppsala, could have all the cash, get going. It was all ready to go. And on the very day I published a piece in the Telegraph again, celebrating our triumph. That was the day Dido died.
In 2013, the day that publication was posted.
Yeah. So I withdrew from it after that. I wasn't really interested anymore after that. I didn't want to hear anything about it, to be honest. But Vince lived a bit longer, and he kept pushing, and then he died. And it wavered for a moment, because there's nothing written down. They'd made this promise to him that should he live and should he still be a suitable candidate come the time, they would treat him in the trial. But now that he died, would the money keep coming in? You know, would his widow honor the agreement? And so on. So it looked a bit touch and go for a while, but his widow was marvelous. She said, of course I'll honor the agreement. What's more, Vince had left a foundation, a cache of money, specifically to promote research and awareness about neuroendocrine cancer. So there was a good amount of money lying about. And she continues, and has been magnificent ever since his death, continues to support Uppsala's work and is really responsible for this drug finally coming into trials.
And so this journey that you started to try to help a friend, it took time. We lost Dido, we lost Vince, and the legacy from that, though, is this potentially disruptive and transformational new model that you have been able to drive forward together with Professor Essen from Uppsala. And now even look not only at that first virus and the impact now that patients are getting access to it through a clinical trial that otherwise would not have happened, but now even beginning to look at, as you were saying, other medical research that is sitting on the shelf, that where there's not funding being made available today through conventional means. Is this model the future for advancing medicines that are prioritized to patients?
I think there's, well, what's happened is after I found, you know, after I did Uppsala, I became aware that there was quite a lot of neglected medication about. Now, I'm not saying it's any good. It might not be any good. But it's not been neglected for scientific reasons. It's been neglected largely for reasons that boil down to finance. And the sort of sums involved, the several millions, the $2 to $5 million, are sums of money that, you know, some bankers receive in a bonus. Yeah. So they're smallish sums. They're big for me, but they're not big for someone who has a really substantial amount of money and who has this disease, whatever the disease might be. So if you are such a person, this was my reasoning, and you get this disease, and you know early on that there are these neglected therapeutics about that you might be able to invest in order to bring them into trials, and they would be prepared to allow you on the trial once it is ready, then you'd be kind of a fool not to invest in it.
Yeah.
And so I then teamed up with me and Dominic Nutt, this other journalist. We now work together on this. We teamed up with the ethics department, University of Oxford. They became very interested in the idea. Professor Savulescu and Professor Ilana Singh there are working with us to try and tease out just what the ethical complications are and which of them are serious complications and which are not. And the critical thing to it, the thing that makes it not this awful business of just some rich, swaggering person with a disease coming in saying, oi, I want your medication, here's the money, bung it into me, is that the whole thing has to be, and I spent some long time working on this with various ethicists and various scientists and lawyers here in England for an article for the Wellcome Trust, for Mosaic magazine in the Wellcome Trust. And I called it the plutocratic proposal. And the idea is that you have your plutocrat who wants to invest in this neglected therapeutic and your research lab that has the neglected therapeutic for which they cannot get the funding from the usual sources, but which still seems to hold, promise. And they are separated by what I call the dating agency. Now, this dating agency, this organization in the middle, acts as a buffer between the two. It's a source of funds for the research lab, but it is also an organization that sets up a peer review to make sure that the research is good, that has a standing ethics panel to make sure that the arrangement between the funder and the research lab is a proper one and isn't a case of, as it would, I imagine, be possibly the funder trying to bully the researchers into adjusting their research in a certain way. So everything is done through this middle organization. And when you introduce that, and I think if you set it up properly, and as I say, with Oxford, I was trying to figure out a way, trying to figure out exactly how you need to do it to set it up properly. Certainly all of the substantial ethical objections that I've come across, and I've asked a lot of people, and people have thrown a lot at me, all of them vanish.
So the process can stand up. It can stand up to ethicists. Do you sense that that this window of 2 or 3 years that's required to get a study up, when the data exists, when the funding is getting secured, do you feel like there are opportunities there that and how do we progress in that space to compress those timelines to getting that medication, that investigational medicine into the hands of patients?
Well, that's not my expertise at all, but it was interesting to watch Vince at work once he decided this is what he wanted. The first thing he did is fly out to the production facility that was going to get this drug made up to GMP and immediately secured a 25% reduction. Then he flew to Uppsala and immediately secured another reduction. So he reduced the amount of money everyone had to pay. He got onto things. He started effectively kicking people around and making them work. He was motivated by, it has to be frank, his own desperation, but also by his sense of he just wanted a business model in this thing. He wanted the thing to work efficiently. And so although I can't answer your question specifically in terms of what needs to be adjusted and so on and so forth, because I don't know, I do feel that by introducing this business element backed up by the desperation, you bring in a sort of urgency or a sort of force that was lacking. Because, you know, things happen at the lab. You know, something might go on. There might be, well, it turned out there had been some miscommunication between the manufacturing facility and the university, and this caused a 6-month delay. If Vince had been around, that delay would not have happened. He'd have known about it on the Saturday. It would have been corrected by the Monday. Yeah. He just could work like that. And I think when you have someone with that sort of mind involved, and this model would want to get that sort of mind involved, I think you stand a chance of moving things a little bit faster than 3 years. Maybe not a year you couldn't get it down to, but maybe a year and a half. I don't know that. I'm speaking out of my expertise in that.
But bringing that sense of urgency and discipline that Vince was bringing to his business and other dealings, and how to bring that into the way that decisions are being made in a timely manner, and making sure those handoffs are precise and keeping that ball moving. So I just want to read this one opening paragraph. This week, an accidental revolution in cancer research has begun in a Swedish university lab. It's a revolution that by rights should never have even started. Today, however, two profoundly clever and unassuming scientists and a bemused British author stand on the cusp of greatness. That's the opening paragraph in the article that Dominic Nutt posted in the Telegraph just this very week. And Alexander, it has been really an honor to speak with you, not only today, last year when we had a chance to meet in London at the DPharm event. Your persistence in this, both on behalf of DITO up front in pursuing the right level of information and continuing to pursue this now in many ways in her legacy, really is a revolutionary moment. And I thank you for sharing your story this today with our listeners.
Well, thank you very much. And I also want to send that thanks to all the people who were involved in the crowdfunding campaign, because they were a magnificent group.
And I'll just step in here. Valerie, Alexander, huge congratulations on the progress. It's so inspiring. And Alexander and Craig know that in my family, I too lost somebody to the same cancer, neuroendocrine tumor on the pancreas. And so it really is so wonderful to see the progress and how I hope that this journey can help inspire others for any disease area that is underfunded and needs help. And so with that, again, I'd like to thank Craig and Alexander for this wonderful program. And for more information about other programs and the next DPHARM event, please visit www.theconferenceforum.org. And thank you so much to both of you again.
Thank you.